Hello and welcome to T-12 from Fueling Endurance. I'm Alan McCubbin. I'm an accredited sports dietitian based in Melbourne and have almost 20 years experience working with runners, cyclists and triathletes to help them stay healthy and optimize their performance from complete beginners through to professional and Olympic athletes. And in this second episode of our special six-part podcast series, we're catching up with our guest athlete Brett as he prepares for his upcoming race Ultra Trail Australia. With 10 weeks left till race day now, we'll review Brett's day-to-day diet and the changes made last time we caught up with him. Brett reports back on trying some race foods that will be provided on course during the event, and we get started on some gut training and understanding his hydration needs. Now remember, if you're racing Ultra Trail Australia, or you have a different running, cycling or triathlon event coming up in May or June, you can follow along with us, implementing the same principles and strategies that Brett does to help you succeed at your event. But before we get to Brett, I've got one quick announcement to make. For almost 12 months now, well before Steph finished up with the podcast, the two of us had been discussing whether or not we would be open to paid sponsorships or promotions on the podcast. We didn't have anything lined up at the time, but we knew that one day or another we would have to provide a yes or a no answer because someone was inevitably going to approach us. In the end, we decided that we would be open to these opportunities because podcasts might be free to listen to, but I can assure you they're definitely not free to make and to host. But we did agree that we'd only ever say yes to any partnership on our terms. Specifically, we wouldn't do any partnerships, sponsorships, or endorsements of specific foods or supplement products or brands. Both of us take our roles as health professionals seriously, and that includes being brand agnostic when it comes to the inevitable questions that we get asked about one product or another from the athletes that we work with, or of course from listeners on the podcast. Secondly, any other partnership would have to be related to products or services we felt comfortable recommending to athletes and clients that we work with personally. In the past week, we've taken our first step on this journey and partnered with an Australian sports nutrition business, which you'll hear about later during today's episode. They fulfill our criteria of being brand agnostic from a product perspective, and we have recommended them in the past to athletes that we've worked with. So with all that said, let's get straight into this one and catch up with our guest athlete, Brett Kennedy. All right, Brett, welcome back. It's been a couple of weeks since we last caught up with you. How have things been over the last couple of weeks, both sort of training-wise, and then obviously we'll get into the nutrition in a sec?
Yeah, training's been going well. It's been nice to kind of ramp things up again after just a few weeks recovering from my last event. So, just ticking off the Ks. At the moment, it's a bit of a tempo focus, so a bit more intensity with recovery days in between. But yeah, so far so good.
The first thing I wanted to check with Brett was his day-to-day eating. You'll recall in the last episode I had a look at his daily diet and suggested a few tweaks, nothing massive, that were aimed at really distributing his carbs across the week around key training sessions better, having some more routine to his snacks, and I don't think I specifically mentioned it on the podcast, but I also wanted to ensure that he was consistently meeting his calcium requirements, which were a little bit hit and miss previously. So let's hear how he's gone with those changes in the last couple of weeks.
It's been good. It's certainly been helpful having a bit more of a guide to follow. You know, I've been away for work since we last spoke and things have been busy, but, you know, kind of having those milestones to hit throughout the day and, you know, when I should be getting some carbs in and getting ready for the sessions. I've certainly noticed with all my runs, I'm feeling good, fueling in those longer sessions as well, to make sure that the quality's there. So yeah, it's going good.
Yep. And one of the things I always like to check, so when I'm reviewing what someone's been eating, if they've changed what they're doing day to day, is a couple of things. And I think you ticked off one of them there, is energy and training seems to be okay. Like, you're not struggling through sessions. It doesn't sound like it was a major problem before that we were trying to solve, but it's obviously not worse, which is great. Just in terms of hunger and satiety, so like how full you're feeling or how hungry you're getting during the day, are you noticing any changes in there or things just sort of ticking along as they were before?
It just really seems to be just ticking along pretty similar. Might be waking up maybe a little bit hungrier at the moment, just slightly. And that's really because I had a few weeks where, probably wasn't training as much, wasn't burning through as much. So yeah, just getting on top of that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And I guess then the recovery side of things and just like general levels of energy and fatigue outside of training? Has that been any different to before?
I probably haven't really thought about that too much before this conversation, but I actually think that I have been having less of those kind of cloudy patches at times. And that might be just because I'm, just kind of adhering a bit more to a schedule, I guess, rather than just snacking here or there or whatnot. So it's just helping me stay, I suppose, a bit more balanced. So
Okay. No, that's good. That's good. Now, in terms of that plan we set up last time, I mean, yeah, there wasn't any massive, you know, dramatic changes that we'd made anyway, because what you're doing was generally going along okay. I guess it was putting, as you said, a little bit more structure around the snacking side of things, with the aim of just putting you into a small but not massive calorie deficit around sort of body weight, body fat side of things. And the other aspect, I guess, was planning both your meals and your snacks, kind of the carbohydrate fueling around training. So supporting those sessions where you probably need more fuel and then, you know, pulling back a little bit at the times where it's not going to make so much of a difference. Are you finding that's easy to kind of get into that routine of now in terms of, you know, when I need to ramp up that fueling a little bit more because of a certain session coming up versus when I can sort of hold back a little bit, but then maybe fill up with a bit more, say, veggies, for example, so that I'm not more hungry, but I'm just getting a little bit less in?
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, I recently went away for work and, you know, I was able to kind of prepare ahead of time, knowing, you know, and have a mixture of a session and some recovery while away. So just knowing what I need to do and even, you know, the night before meals, eating away, like I was just able to kind of probably just rather than eat whatever, make informed choice depending on what I was doing running wise. And I certainly think one area where it's helping me is also just with my protein intake. So I don't think it's been an issue, but like now in the past where I might have just had, you know, maybe something more carb heavy, just having, again, that structure, I think is really helping me just make sure that I'm getting my protein in throughout the day as well for that recovery side of things. Yeah, which is good.
Yep, cool. Any noticeable change sort of body composition-wise, either just in terms of how clothes fit or, I don't know, if you've weighed yourself since last time and looked at any change there?
I've not weighed. I probably have noticed just waking up. Waking up and throughout the day just probably feeling a bit less, not bloated, but, yeah, just feeling a bit more comfortable, I suppose, throughout the day. Not that it was a huge thing, but you do feel it. Like you do feel these small changes and, certainly just feeling just a bit more comfortable and, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of different takes on, you know, weighing yourself and looking at body composition change. You know, some people are very much weighing is a fast ticket to eating disorders, and I think for some people that may be the case. For other people it's probably not, and I tend to probably take a risk-based approach to that. And I guess if you're trying to actively change body composition, you kind of need some feedback of is it being successful or not. I guess if you are weighing yourself, and probably for listeners as well, if you are choosing to weigh yourself, I guess the things I'd probably suggest is no more than once a week, unless it's for another purpose like sweat rate testing, which we'll get into later in this episode. But yeah, I think, you know, no more than once a week, because you're just going to pick up noise rather than signal there, because, you know, you have natural fluctuations in weight as you fluid gains and losses, carbohydrates and glycogen store gains and losses that happen as we train and recover. And so those natural variations will occur across the week. So you don't really need or want to pick up those things and get worried about nothing, really. So I just usually suggest no more than once a week, trying to do it on the same day of the week at the same time of the day, you know, just to try and control things as much as you possibly can to minimize the effect of those noise factors there and that natural variation. You know, first thing in the morning after you've got up and gone to the toilet is probably the most consistent, I suppose, time to do it. It doesn't have to be at that time, but that's generally what I'd recommend if it's practical to do so. And, you know, and again, not panicking if it hasn't changed in 1 week or 2 weeks. Like, it's not going to be this perfect linear change, either weight gain or weight loss. It's going to be, you know, sort of ups and downs, but it's the trend heading in the direction that you want it to. And that's ultimately the important thing, and that's going to take place over several weeks.
Yeah, I've probably had a mindset shift there as well, just around, yeah, it's easy to kind of get caught up in the number but really coming to understand that I'm trying to train for performance and not aesthetics, and don't want things to get out of hand, but I've got to prioritize the performance over aesthetics if I want to get the results I'm after.
Yeah, totally agree. And yeah, that's the big caveat on all of this is, you know, going into an energy deficit, if it's not too severe or not for too long, that isn't necessarily going to be a problem. But at the same time, if it starts compromising training performance, well, you might be lighter, but you're not faster, and you're probably just less powerful, which is ultimately not a good thing overall. So yeah, totally agree with that. All right, well, it doesn't sound like there's anything that dramatically needs to change in terms of that day-to-day plan. I think it sounds like from what you've said, it's just a matter of continuing on as is for now.
Yeah, I think, and like substituting in milk and things like that too has been like, that was a good pickup. Like, yeah, you know, I'm not a big kind of milk, cheese, like dairy thing consumer really. It's just not really something I go to. So just swapping over the milk, it's actually made the protein probably a bit more tolerable at times too than watered protein. So yeah.
Yeah. And I think for listeners, we didn't talk about that last time, but the rationale behind that was, I think that your calcium intake was probably a little on the low side. So we just, when you're having your protein shakes with water, we just swap that to milk just to try and increase the calcium content a little bit, because your typical protein shakes, if it's a whey protein, for example, it's originally derived from dairy products. The process that sort of isolates those proteins removes most of everything else along the way, including the calcium. So yeah, your isolated proteins won't have much, if any, calcium in them. And so we're sort of getting that back from using milk rather than water. And sometimes that means you can use a little less protein powder because you're getting some protein in the milk itself. You'll recall last episode, Brett and I discussed his accommodation choices for race day as well, which is already booked and gives him full kitchen facilities in an Airbnb, which is perfect for those last days before a race. And we also discussed that he's not got any crew this year and he needs to be fully self-sufficient. Now, whenever you're doing an event that requires a lot of race day nutrition, but there's no crew access, I always encourage athletes to use the race-provided products from aid stations as much as possible. It means that you don't have to rely on drop bags, which can be hit and miss, or have to carry around your whole race nutrition with you throughout the entire race. But the number one rule in sports nutrition is that you never, ever, ever try something on race day that you haven't practiced with in training. And for Brett and UTA, this meant getting hold of the NARC drink mix, bars and waffles that are provided by the event organisers, and work out if they'll be a good option to build into his race nutrition plan or not. And this is where we've been very fortunate to partner with Aid Station to provide Brett with products from the NARC range for him to practice with in training. Aid Station is an online sports nutrition retailer here in Australia that I've followed for quite a while now. And what I really like about them is that they stock a huge range of different sports nutrition brands, including those used in most of the main running, cycling, and triathlon events here in Australia. And the best part is that you don't have to buy a whole box of the same gel just to get one and see if you actually like it or not. You can buy single drink mix sachets, bars, gels, and waffles, and you can mix and match different flavors and different brands to get whatever you need. They'll then hand pack that into a single box and deliver it right to your door, anywhere in Australia, New Zealand, and now overseas as well. It also saves you the hassle of running around to multiple stores to find the specific products that you're looking for, which has always been a big bugbear of mine. I was doing a project a few years ago and it took me almost half a day to source about 10 different products from different brands and different flavors. So a big thanks to Aid Station for supporting the podcast and of course Brett's preparation for UTA. You can find them at aidstation.com.au. But now let's get back to the conversation with Brett. Have you already sort of got some sense of, you know, either new things that you've found that you do like or things that you've kind of ruled out and go, not really sure about that. Maybe we'll work around that rather than using it.
Yeah, so I've tried a bit of everything and certainly when it comes to the waffles and bars, I've had waffles before similar and have taken them with me in races. So they were good. The bars are good and almost potentially as a day-to-day snack as well. You know, it's one of those ones I could see. It really depends what kind of intensity you're putting out with the chewing down a more solid food, but quite good. Drink mix was certainly different to other drink mixes I've had. So that's something I think, you know, I would like to just continue to use and become familiar with just because on the day, if that's something I need to turn to, I don't want to be really struggling with that.
Yeah. And I think you can use it in a couple of different ways. Like that could be your plan A, like that's what I'm planning to use for the race. But it also could be, and I think you're kind of alluding to this now, like your plan B, which is like if the stuff I was planning to have, either it's been lost or I spilt it on the ground, or, you know, my flavor preferences have just changed big time mid-race and I just can't stand that anymore, then I've got a second option there I can go to and pick that up at aid stations along the way. It could be used in either context. I guess for you, because you don't have crew on the day, you know, accessing drink powder that's not the one that's provided on course, you're either going to have to use drop bags a lot or carry it all with you in Ziploc bags right from the start of the event, or at least have at least one or two drop bags along the way where you can kind of pick up, you know, a third of the event's worth at a time kind of thing. So, yeah, I think see how you go with that in terms of whether you feel that that will be ended up being a plan A solution or a plan B solution, I suppose. And then we can kind of, you know, as we get closer to race day, we can formulate a bit more of a plan around that in terms of are you going to use other products or are you going to rely mostly on the NARC product?
Yeah, I'd certainly recommend people jump on aid station and pick some up though, just to... particularly with the drink mix, if it's something where you think I might end up having to use that, it's just worthwhile. It is a bit different to, I suppose, some of the other products. Not bad different, just different. So it's just something that it's worth having a test with anyway. And the bars and waffles are great. Like I said, whether it's when you're out running or you're looking for a snack. So.
yeah, absolutely. Any other kind of sort of more DIY foods or fluids or other commercial products that you're sort of looking at and thinking, yeah, this might form part of what I end up using as well?
I have used a lot of Precision Hydration, the 30 gram gels, or have probably more recent times started using a bigger gel that has
another 90 gram.
Yeah, the 90 gram, the lid, because then you can just kind of sip it, if you will, and, you know, and get down what you need, and it just seems a bit more convenient and less of a hassle rubbish wise. A little bit bulkier, but it's, yeah, that lid, the convenience of a lid, helps sort that out. And that's probably, you know, just with that one, there's not much of a flavor, so it's something that I've not really grown tired of from a flavor fatigue point of view. And then probably just looking at maybe some more real foods, smaller size real foods in there, particularly leaning more towards something savory to combat some of the sweet, because I do tend to have a lot of sweet stuff, sweet flavored things, and you can only have that for so long.
Yes, definitely. Have there been sort of more of those savory things that you've used in like in past events that you thought kind of were helpful or worked well for you?
It's something I've reflected on, because I've taken different things at different times, like mini muffins and just little things like that. But there's a couple of times now that I recall in events that things that a slice of bread was honestly just a plain slice of bread at different times was something that really helped reset myself, like just get me back to eating. You know, I guess it might soak up a bit in the stomach. It seemed to go down all right. You know, it was whether or not that just came at the right time in those events, but whether I put something on that as well. But I could just see a little sandwich or something like that is probably something I need to, you know, start training with and thinking about.
Yeah. And the way I like to usually use that in ultra distance events is you can make up sandwiches. Obviously, you can put whatever filling you want in them. I guess the first thing I'd say is go for white bread. Like, you don't need extra fiber going in during a race. That's just not going to be helpful. The other thing is I would usually cut the crusts off, because that's a lot of chewing for not much benefit, particularly if you're doing it while you're running. Maybe if you're stopping at a checkpoint to eat it, slightly different story. The other thing I like to do, again, if you're eating them on the go, is once you've made your sandwich, you've cut the crust off, is to actually squash the bread down to get all the air out of it, and it ends up sort of like the thickness of a pancake. And then you can cut it either into quarters or into strips, and then wrap it in a bit of aluminium foil, because alfoil will be really easy to tear open during a race, whereas, you know, you cling wrap it, it's like the kid in the schoolyard is trying to open their sandwich and find where the end of the cling wrap is and like pick it all apart to open it up. That's the last thing you want sort of mid-race. You just want something that you can just tear open and start eating straight away. So, yeah, there's certainly things that I would generally do if I was doing sort of sandwich or, you know, bread-based things. In terms of fillings in it, yeah, you got plenty of options, both sweet and savoury. You know, some people on the sweet side would go for sort of something like jam. I generally wouldn't recommend honey because it tends to soak through the bread and just end up being a bit of a sticky mess. Yeah. So it doesn't tend to work that well, but, you know, if you're happy with that. But other ones on the sweet side might be things like Nutella. Often people don't think about that as a potential option, or Biscoff or something like that. So that's on the sweet side of things. On the savoury side of things, peanut butter is probably the obvious one that you could go with. You know, you probably wouldn't use heaps of it because you don't want a huge amount of fat going in. But just a small amount of that would be absolutely fine, particularly in ultra distance type stuff. And the other one, certainly here in Australia, would be Vegemite. You know, super salty. A lot of us would have grown up with it and don't mind it. And often when you're just crying out for something salty in a race, it really hits the spot. But for people outside Australia listening to this, they're probably vomiting in their mouth as they listen to this. But yeah, it's certainly not everyone's cup of tea, I'll admit that. But yeah, for us Aussies here, that can often be a really useful one mid-race as well. Have you played around with some of those options before, like during a race?
Yeah, certainly, Brett. Not you know, bread with the spread on it. But I could see myself anything from, yeah, a jam to a peanut butter would probably be where I'd land. And outside of that, yeah, there's certainly been, you know, hot cross buns, muffins, depending on the time of year with the hot cross buns. But kind of that bread-based stuff for me. I've tried with some other things. Fruit doesn't seem to go too well for me. You know, I'd love to be able to just have bananas and keep on going, but then I just get a bit, all I can taste is banana it doesn't sit as well. And I found the same things like watermelon. Like, you want that fresh hit, especially, like, you know, in a long race, you want that something fresh, but it just afterwards doesn't seem to sit well with me. So,
yeah. The other things, I'm just looking at the list here that I often use with athletes for ultra distance events. The other things that sort of spring to mind, again, there's sort of a mix of sweet and savory here, would be things like the baked fruit bars. So you can imagine like the Kellogg's K-Time bars. I find they're quite dry though, but there are, certainly here in Australia, the supermarket sort of home brand versions of those are better from that perspective. They're cheaper as well, which also helps. But they give you sort of a similar amount of carbs to a gel. The LCM bars, the Kellogg's LCM bars, which are like puffed rice, kind of all stuck together, a little bit lower in carbs, but super light and really easy to eat. So they can be a good one as well. Some people like the ginger nut biscuits, just for the ginger flavor. Sometimes for nausea, the ginger can be a little bit helpful as well. Probably not as much in those biscuits because there's not that much of it. But, you know, just as a different flavor, you can go for... Again, on the sweet side of things, you know, snakes or, you know, your lollies, your jelly beans, your gummy bears, that kind of thing. You know, probably a bit more chewing and swallowing compared to a gel, but it couldn't just be a good break in terms of flavor and texture and things as much as anything. It can be things like even crushed potato crisps, some people will go for the savoriness of them. And, you know, I say crushed because they usually end up getting crushed anyway if you're carrying them on you. And so, you know, having them in a Ziploc bag or something that you can kind of just tip it up and pour all the crumbs into your mouth, that can work. And a lot of people like that kind of thing. You know, the rice cakes that have sort of come around in professional cycling over the years, where you have like sushi rice and hold it together with other ingredients, that can be helpful. But I guess you have to be mindful that if it's sitting around in the sun for 10 hours, it's certainly a significant food poisoning risk. And so you've got to be careful about that. And so for you not having crew access, it may not be the most practical option for you unless you're literally starting the race with it and it's the first couple of items that you're having in the event as well.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to the drinks, bars, gels, and DIY snacks that Brett will eat between checkpoints, we also discussed the fact that in an ultra-distance event, you can get physically hungry out on the trail, as well as that flavour fatigue element that tends to steer you away from sweet foods and towards more savoury foods. And for many ultra runners, this means actually stopping briefly at checkpoints to eat something a little more substantial, often a small hot meal at kind of your typical meal times. But things are a little bit trickier for Brett this year because he doesn't have that support crew to heat the food and hand it to him like a lot of people will rely on in these ultra trail events. So that's some homework for Brett over the next few weeks to try out the products he's received from MaidStation, as well as those DIY products and potentially some more substantial meals that we might be able to use in drop bags and have him pick up along the way. Now, the next item for today's catch-up was to start collecting some sweat rate data in order to plan Brett's fluid needs for race day. So let's have a listen to that conversation now. What I want to talk about today, I guess, is gathering a bit more data that's going to help inform that race plan as it all comes together. So there's two parts to that. One is understanding your fluid needs during a race. So looking at actually your sweat losses during training. So basically what we want to do is build what I call a sort of a sweat rate profile. And this is acknowledging the fact that in a long race like UTA, your sweat rate isn't going to be this sort of fixed number across the entire duration of the event. Like, you're starting early in the morning when it's going to be quite cool. It's going to get warm in the middle of the day. You're finishing in the dark when there's no sun around. So your sweat rate, you would expect, even if you're running on a track at exactly the same pace, would change as the weather changes across the day. But of course, with a race like UTA, there's big differences in terrain as well, which is also going to change the sweat rate in terms of times where you're going uphill versus downhill, how much sun exposure you do or don't have, how much wind exposure you do or don't have. Like, all of those factors are going to kind of play into this. So what we ultimately want to do is build a bit of a profile of, like, in the cooler conditions, this is kind of what my sweat rate is likely to look like at race pace. In the hottest conditions expected on the day, in the middle of the day, this is kind of what we expect it to look like. And then maybe even at nighttime, this is what we expect it to look like. And that helps when it comes to, you know, planning your hydration, and particularly in an event like this where you've got to carry a lot of your fluid between checkpoints for multiple hours at a time, is to work out, well, how much fluid do you actually need to carry with you? To one, make sure you've got enough or that you don't run out between those checkpoints, but also that you're not carrying around all this extra weight unnecessarily that you don't need to carry either. And I've seen both happen in races. Probably more actually carrying excessive fluid, like people just loading up and carrying kilos around on their back that they never end up using. And yeah, what's the point of that? So yeah, that's definitely one of the things I think is worth starting to work on. And it won't just be the next 2 weeks, it'll probably be over the next kind of 4 or 6 weeks that you kind of do that. And so what that involves is basically going out and weighing yourself before and after training sessions. I guess the training sessions I would do this in would be ones that are kind of more reflective of 100K race pace. So if you're going out and doing like your tempo training and those interval type sessions that you mentioned before, like, you're always going to end up with a higher sweat rate because you're working harder in those sessions than you would in a 100K race. So for those ones, probably not as important, but for the ones that are more reflective of race pace, that's where it's worth trying to capture that data. A couple of things that we're going to do is, yeah, weigh yourself before and after the session, but we're also going to track how much fluid you drink over the session. So whether that's, you know, filling fluids up to a known amount and then just seeing how much is left, that can work. Or you can physically weigh your bottles, bladders, flasks, whatever it is, before and afterwards and measure the difference there. So we're going to track how much weight you're losing, how much fluid you drank. The other things we're going to have a look at is your gut tolerance of that fluid. So we've just got a simple sort of 0 to 10 scale, and you can sort of rate your gut symptoms at the end of the session. And the other thing we're going to do is rate your thirst at the end of the session as well. And the reason that we do that is it's one thing to know how much fluid you're losing in these different conditions, and it's one thing to know how much you're drinking and is that enough. But if it's not enough, we want to know, why is it not enough? So what are the barriers to getting you to, you know, hydrate as effectively as we can? Is it, I just didn't bring enough fluid with me, we just need to plan to carry more? Is it a gut tolerance issue, I can't tolerate that fluid, so we need to do some more specific gut training around that? Or is it a sort of a disconnect between your sensation of thirst or how you interpret that versus how much fluid you actually need? And so if that's the case, obviously we have to have a think about how we can work on that as well. So yeah, I do that, you know, across, as I said, sessions that kind of are reflective of race pace to try and reflect the amount of body heat that you're going to be producing. And then as much as you can, it's not always easy to fit around work and life and everything, different types of conditions that you might expect on race day as well. So, you know, the cool times early in the morning and then the times in the middle of the day where it's a bit warmer. But it could also just be variations in terms of a cold day versus a hot day will help account for that, even if it is the same time of day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely, like, you know, UTA, I've seen everything from, you know, 2021, there was, it was sleeting at the start and one of the coldest ones I think they've started, but the actual conditions were fine. And I definitely find once you get out in the valley in that first loop, both times that I've been out there, it surprisingly warms up compared to up around the cliffs. It's not hot, but when the sun's out, you really do notice that temperature change. And I think it does affect people. You do start for that time of year, it does, depending on conditions, it does have an impact.
Yeah, and down in the valleys, like, you just don't get the same airflow that you do up top as well, for sure. Yeah, okay. So, let's see how you go for that over the next few weeks, trying to pick out sessions. Generally, I would suggest sessions that are longer than an hour, but probably less than 3 hours, because sessions less than an hour, like, your sweat rate takes a while to kind of ramp up to that level it's kind of going to sit at in the longer term. And so, you'll probably get an underestimate if you only do it for an hour or less. But if you go more than 3 hours, you start to get into a scenario where the weight change is not necessarily an accurate reflection of just fluid losses. There's other things start to come into play that are significant. Is that a process that you've been through in the past?
Nothing too serious. I've certainly seen and read about it, have gone for, an hour run and kind of done the, an hour run with no water or anything and kind of tried to work it out. But again, nothing that I've ever really probably implemented back into a plan. So.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, well, we'll see how you go with that in terms of capturing that data as we go. Any questions on, how to do that?
Just with, say, if I was doing a long run, maybe a couple of hours, do I factor in any food that I'm fueling with? Am I better to do liquid nutrition at that point? Just, strictly liquid nutrition, just to, I can weigh my bottles and I know exactly what, it's...
Hmm.
Factoring that in,
yeah. I mean, you can factor for solid food. So you just enter, and there's a spot in the spreadsheet for this. So you just enter the weight of the food before and then afterwards. So, some people might actually just, if they've got kitchen scales, stick all their food in the wrappers on the scale and then just weigh the leftover wrappers and any leftover foods that you didn't need at the end, and then just you can do it that way. Or if you just know, I had 3 bars and they're 30 grams each, just put 90 grams and 0 grams for afterwards. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. And I think, sometimes we get caught up in, measuring that to the last gram. But the reality is when you're measuring your body weight, it's in 100 gram increments anyway. So by definition, it's never going to be more accurate than that. So there's no point, worrying about, a 5 gram difference here or a 10 gram difference there, because the measurement resolution of your body weight component of it isn't that accurate anyway.
Yeah. And this is probably falls into that category, but is there any consideration for gear and, do I load up the vest? Because I know it can be up to, 3 or 4 kilos extra on your back and obviously on your body, covering your core, I suppose. Is it worthwhile?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, if you really want to go to town with it, I think that's a good idea, actually, is to try and not just simulate the pace but simulate the gear that you're wearing on race day as well, simply because, as you said, it's going to cover up the skin. It's going to affect how effectively sweat can evaporate from your body and cool you down. So it will actually have an impact on your sweat rate. And most people would know this. If you put a pack on your back, you're probably going to sweat a little bit more than you would otherwise. So yeah, you don't need to weigh that, because obviously you're just weighing yourself preferably with as little on as possible before and after, and drying yourself before you do that. The post-exercise weigh-in as well, just to get any sweat that's still on your body and your hair out. Yeah, so yes, I would wear that, but you don't need to weigh it before and after, because you're just putting it on in the in-between phase.
Yep.
Okay, so some more homework for Brett to collect some sweat rate data now. And with the additional information captured, we'll have a profile of sweat rates, along with some really useful contextual data around gut tolerance and thirst perception that will help us interpret that data when it's all collected in a few weeks' time. So the final thing today for Brett was to get him started with some gut training. Now, this is particularly important for him since gut issues, and in his case, particularly nausea, was one of his biggest challenges that he's facing and has caused him to DNF this race last year, as well as another ultra that he did at the start of this year as well. So let's get back to the conversation and shifting the focus from hydration to gut training. There's kind of three different aspects to gut training, if you like. One is the tolerance of just volume of stuff in your stomach and having the stomach be able to stretch to accommodate that in terms of solid foods. And the way we would generally do that is eating not necessarily a massive meal, but eating relatively close to when you're training. And if you think about it, during a race, that's exactly what you're going to do. You know, you come into a checkpoint and you have your 2 minute noodles or your whatever it is, and then you have to run straight away again. And, you know, but despite that, you know, so many people will avoid eating for 2, even up to 4 hours before they do their training runs, day in, day out. And it's like, well, of course, you get into a race, things don't work. What did you expect if you've never done that in training? So doing that, I think, is a really important one. And so that's just as much of a timing thing as necessarily eating something differently. It might just be timing your meals around your training sessions or your snacks. So that's one aspect to it. The second aspect to it is the fluid tolerance. Now, this is probably not something I would set out initially to do unless we know that there's a fluid issue here. So that's where that hydration testing is going to become important, because that's going to provide us feedback to say, well, based on this, it's not a problem, so we can just skip over this completely. Or yes, there is a fluid tolerance issue, let's go and do that. So I think we'll cross that bridge when we get to it, so don't worry about that just now. And then the third one is the ability to digest and absorb the amount of carbohydrate that you want to take during the race. So, you know, the grams an hour value of carbs that you're having. Now, I think we might have talked about this last time. Can you just remind me how many grams of carbs you've tended to aim for on race day before?
It's typically around 70.
Okay.
70 to 80.
Yeah. Okay. And have you found, I mean, nausea aside, and I mean, that may be related to it, but have you found generally that is tolerated okay without, you know, sensations of, you know, feeling like you get reflux or vomit it back up, or sort of lower gut symptoms in terms of bloating, gas, needing to open your bowels, that kind of thing?
Yeah, particularly for the first 4 to 5 hours, I don't seem to have any problems at all. You know, it's difficult because training, I've never had issues, but I never run long enough to get to the point where I might experience them, it seems. So, yeah.
Mm. Yep. And when you do train, do you tend to train with that quantity of carbohydrate?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. So in a sense, you're kind of doing that gut training already, because you're having those quantities in training that you plan to have on race day. Sometimes you can push that a little bit more in training and actually deliberately over-fuel during training. Not every session of the week. This might be like once or twice a week. Because if you know you can tolerate, say, 90 grams an hour, then theoretically 70 should be pretty straightforward. So that, you know, you might deliberately go maybe, say, 20% above what you plan to race at, to race at that lower value. And I mean, I'll do some calculations between now and next time we catch up to just get an estimate of like how much, you know, how many grams of carbs do we think you actually need? Because when you get to ultra distance stuff, you know, we talk about in pro cycling and things like that, you know, 90, 100, more than 100 grams an hour of carbohydrate, and that has crept into ultra running a little bit as well. You see some of the elite guys at UTMB with those kind of values. But the question is, do we actually need that much? Do we get to a situation in ultra running, because the intensity is lower, we're actually consuming more carbohydrate than we're using, and we're actually excessively fueling? So that is possible in ultra distance events. Probably more so in smaller athletes, because they just burn less calories per kilometer run, because there's less of them, less weight to move around. Obviously, you're pretty tall, so you're probably at the other end of the spectrum from that perspective. But yeah, it is something certainly to consider with this. But yeah, I think we start off particularly with that sort of eating before you run, and then maybe even picking one or two training sessions a week. Maybe it's one of the longer sessions, and then maybe one of the slightly more intense sessions to deliberately sort of overfuel, you know, up to maybe starting with sort of 80 grams an hour of carbs, and if that's easy, go up to 90 or 95 and just see how that feels. I would expect, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, but I would expect that when you're gut training, there is going to be some discomfort involved with that, because you're pushing the limits of your tolerance, and the body's not going to adapt unless you give it a reason to adapt, which is sort of pushing that limit. So the analogy I like to use is, if you go out and do a training session, like a hard interval session or something, and you go, oh, that felt hard, I'm not going to do that anymore because that was uncomfortable, I'm only going to do, you know, zone one recovery runs from here on in, of course you're never going to improve, because you're never pushing the body's ability. You're not forcing it to adapt to anything. And it's the same with gut training. You know, if you go out there and say, oh, that was horrible from now on, I'm just having, you know, 30 grams an hour of carbs and not much fluid, well, of course, your body's never going to adapt to take more carbs because you're never actually providing the stress it needs to get that adaptation happening. So there we have it, our second session completed with Brett. To summarise, I've reviewed the recommended changes to his day-to-day nutrition, and this seems to be working quite well for him, so there's nothing we need to sort of alter in that. And Brett does find the structure of having it written out for him really helpful in terms of his routine as well. We've organised him the race-provided products to try in training, and thanks again to Aidstation for providing those. And he'll continue experimenting with these and other options over the next few weeks before we need to start pulling it all together into his race nutrition plan. Now, Brett's going to go away and collect some sweat rate data and to begin some gut training, both in terms of running on a full stomach and in pushing the hourly carb intake towards a level that hopefully gets to about 20 to 30% above what he actually plans to race with. So in our next episode, T-8, we'll check in on Brett's progress with all this, as well as take a look at his nutrition plan for the days before and the morning of the race. Now that episode will be in 2 weeks' time, but next week we have the next episode of Fueling Endurance, where I answer the question, can my supplement really cause a doping positive? And our special guest to help us answer this question is Kerry O'Brien from Bond University and the Queensland Academy of Sport. Now remember, if you've got a race coming up around May or June, you might like to go through the same steps we've just discussed on the podcast today with Brett, or even go back to the previous episode as well and have a listen to that. If you're not sure about how to do the sweat rate testing, you can go back and have a listen to episode 53 of the podcast, where I run through the sweat testing process in much more detail. And if you want to know more about gut training, episode 41 was dedicated to this. So Steph Gaskell in 41A explained what gut training is and how it can be done. And then in episode 41B, we had Ash Daniels, who's an ultra runner and a coach himself, who has gone through that process and kind of describes that. Just a reminder also, if you do have a question that you'd like answered on the podcast, you can contact us at Fueling Endurance on Instagram, Facebook, or Threads, or Fuel Endurance on X. And remember, there's already been 74 previous questions we have answered on the podcast, so if you are new to the podcast, welcome, but you might like to go and check out that back catalogue because you may find we've already answered that question for you. If you do want to be notified every time a new episode is available, you can hit subscribe on the podcast app that you're listening to this on. And you can also get your hands on the Fueling Endurance ebook through fuelingendurance.com. And that ebook summarizes the first 2 years' worth of podcast episodes and covers 49 of the most common nutrition questions that runners, cyclists, and triathletes ask. But that's it for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope it's been useful. And I hope some of you preparing for UTA are following along with this and getting yourself ready to do some sweat rate testing and some gut training over the next few weeks as well. We'll be back next week, of course, with Fueling Endurance with my guest, Kerry O'Brien. But until then, have a great week and we'll catch you in the next episode.